And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I know that many of you probably read the articles that Rich Buck and I have done and listen to the podcasts. But from the numbers of opens that we can track, it appears that a lot more people listen to the podcast than are reading the articles. And so when we do an article on a topic, this week I'm not sure what title they'll use at MarketWatch because they make up the titles, but when we wrote it, it's about seven things that are important to understand about small cap value and why I think it really can be a life-changing event if we can get a hold of people young enough and get them started as a regular part of their portfolio. Doesn't have to be everything, but certainly a major part. But there's many more than seven. We have a limit as to how many words we can write for Market Watch. Sometimes they'll let us go up to 1,100, 1,200 words, but what they really want is something between 800 and 1,000 words. So I'm going to make sure that I cover what's in that article, at least briefly, and then dig deeper into some of the information that I hope will, if you are a small cap value investor, make you more confident that it's a good decision long term. And for those of you who have this idea that it's a horrible risk to be depending upon a company's whose average size might be $2 or $3 billion compared to the 50 and 75 and $100 billion companies that you get in the S&P 500, my hope is that you will see this long history of success from the small cap value asset class as determined not by Wall Street, but by the academics in their work, their research around asset class selection. So in this, I set out to find 10 solid things that you should know. I'm not even going to count them because I think I'm actually up probably to 15. And I don't want you sitting there thinking, oh my God, we're only at 3 and he's been talking for 20 minutes. But I may have covered 4 or 5 or 6 things actually in that period of time. So just let me loose and I'll share with you why I feel so strongly about this small cap value asset class. And I do think, by the way, that if more people had known about this asset class earlier, you know, 40 years ago, and there had been real-time performance for that many years, I think the confidence would be higher. One of the reasons that John Bogle is such a believer in the S&P 500, remembering it didn't become an index until 1957, but there was all this research on the large companies going back into the mid-20s. And the academics have done a very similar thing with large cap value, small cap blend, and small cap value. And I might say that one of the reasons I am so focused on having you become comfortable with small cap and then to see the difference between investing in small cap blend, a combination of growth and value, and focusing on value as the main asset class. And by the way, when you buy a small cap value ETF or mutual fund, you are going to get a fair amount of small cap growth in there. I mean, that's you in most cases cannot get a pure asset class in terms of size or in terms of the value orientation. But we want it, certainly we want it overweighted to value. So let's talk about some differences that I think make the real reason to be in this asset class. One is the thing that you most want is about performance. And the whole history, going all the way back to 1928, in terms of performance, gives small cap and small cap value a huge advantage over large cap blend. And remember, large cap blend is basically the S&P 500. So we can look back to 1928 through 2016 and see that large cap blend compounded at 9.7. And we show in the, we've done this articles and tables that show the results of large cap blend, large cap value, small cap blend, small cap value, as well as a percentage in all four of those, and focusing only on value. So there's a, we've given you a lot of data along the way, but what we do know is $100 over the 89 years since 1928, or including 1928, that $100 in the S&P 500 turned into $393,000, in large cap value, $1.3 million, in small cap blend, $2.7 million, and in small cap value, $8 million. Now you can see why I'm wanting you to take the time to figure out, can I be comfortable in small cap value for a part of my portfolio? And when you're talking about leaving money to your children or grandchildren, and you want to do the that strategy where you put money away, either a relatively big check on day one, or you put away a smaller amount of money each year for, let's say, 21 years, and then you convert that into Roth IRAs. That's what that article about turning $3,000 into $50 million. You can see why I would dearly love the future, and you probably would too, to look like the past, because you would have done even better than $50 million on that $3,000, if you could again get the return of that 89-year period. But it is a big deal, the difference between 9.7 and 13.5. And yes, it came at more volatility, that extra almost $8 million, $7.6 million came with additional volatility, but really not as big a deal as you may think, and we'll talk about that in just a second. So, what can we learn? What would give us some sense of confidence? Now, I suspect if you looked at every single year since 1928, and you were able to look at what happened with the S&P 500 versus the small cap value index that's been taken back to 1928. I mean, the first thing that you would see, if you looked at it from kind of the 30,000 foot level, is there were long periods that the S&P 500 outperformed small cap value. Now, see, the big risk in small cap value is probably not the normal kinds of recessions that we've had, but rather the punishment that those companies might feel in a real depression. And that happened That happened from 1928 to 1934. In fact, there was only 1 year that small cap value beat the S&P 500 out of that 7 year period, and there were some big wins by the S&P outperforming small cap value by 29% and 19% and 12%. And I can see where somebody would conclude that that's not a good place to be with my long-term money, because I'm losing everything before I even get started, if you happen to start investing back then. So 6 out of 7 years, the S&P 500 wins. I might note that the year that small cap value did do better, they outproduced the S&P by over 70%. But there were a number of those periods. There was the period from 1951 to 1957. Again, 6 out of 7 years, the S&P 500 won, beat small cap value. Another period was from 1984 to 1990. And again, a big difference there. 6 out of 7 years, the S&P beat small cap. And I know from the part of this that I was there and experienced this, that when something doesn't work for most of 7 years, it is real easy to think the marriage is over. This is not something I can trust, because it's hurting me rather than helping me. And as I've said so many times, for young people who are putting money away for their retirement, if this happens in their 20s, it's actually a good thing to be able to get small cap shares inexpensively. But if we want to then look at the flip side of all those years that the S&P beat small cap value, what about the years that small cap value beat the S&P? And there was a period from about 1940 through 47, 6 out of 7 favor small cap value. 1963 to 1968, small beats the S&P. In fact, 1 year by 45%, another year by 37%. There have been some huge wins by small cap when it is in that winning position. And then in a period from, 1974 through the 80s, there was a 9 out of 10 years that small cap value was better. And then, and this is probably what has made small cap value become so believable to people, since 2000, and by the way, I should mention that by 1999, because the S&P had beat small cap for so many years, a lot of people had given up on small cap and said that the premium was gone, that everybody knew about it now, and so the premium would no longer be there. But following that change of heart, what happened was the small cap value came back with a vengeance. And from 2000 to 2010, there 10 out of 11 years, the small cap value beat the S&P 500. And it was a whipping. I mean, it was 29% in 2000 advantage, that much of an additional amount of money that was made, at 40% in 2001 and 38% in 2003 and 24.7% in 2009. So a small cap value over the last 30 years, 6 years were won by the S&P 500 and 24 by small cap value. So you are going to have long periods of underperformance with small cap value, and it will make you wish that you hadn't done that. And the sad and the difficult part is that nobody can say it won't continue? Is it possible that for the next 30 years that large cap blend will win in 24 of those 30 years? I guess it's possible. If it's possible to have the other happen, it's possible to go the other way, just not probable from everything we know about the past. Now, it's always easy and somehow calming when you talk about averages. It just seems like it brings what might be otherwise some wild swings into something more manageable. But just remember, while the market may have compounded at a 10% rate of return over the last 89 years or whatever that number is, maybe it's 9.7%, but there may be only one other year that it had the actual average of all of those years or met that 9.7 compound rate of return. So averages can be deceiving. What is kind of interesting to me is that looking over this 89-year period of time, there were 36 years that the S&P 500 beat small cap value, and the average advantage for the S&P was about 11.2%. Now, when I say that they beat, the S&P beat the small cap value, it certainly doesn't mean that small cap value didn't do okay, like 1995, where the S&P 500 was up 37.6 and small cap value up 31.4. I suspect everybody was relatively happy in a year like that. I think where you find an emotional response is in a year like 1977, when the S&P was down 7 and the small cap value was up 22, or a year like 2001, where the S&P was down 11.9 and small cap value was up 28.6. There can be some huge differences either way, but 36 out of 89 years, the S&P 500 was the outperformer. Again, average outperformance, 11.2%. The other side of that coin is 53 years, small cap value beat the S&P 500, and the outperformance was by 18.3%. So as you look at the whole 89 years, the difference in return on average was 15.4%. And that's a big difference. And where you're going to feel that difference, I think, emotionally and financially too, is when the advantage is to the S&P 500, because it's so easy to take advantage of the S&P 500, much less risk in the minds of investors. And so you can feel a little bit cheated, I suspect, when the S&P 500 is the big winner. And by the way, there's another way to look at these returns on the negative side that I think would possibly make the process easier for people to agree to add some small cap value to a portfolio. And that is to look at what happens during the worst of years. Excuse me, let's just look at all the losing years for the S&P 500. Because it is during that time that you might be afraid of the pain that you would feel from small cap value, that the losses would be much, much bigger. Sometimes they are. In fact, the worst of times happened back in 29 through 33 or 32, really. Those were terrible times for the S&P 500, and the losses were even greater for the small cap value. The big one was the loss of 43%, 43.3, for the S&P 500 in 1931, and a loss of 55.5 for small cap value that year. I mean, they're huge. Both of those are huge losses. And then, while we don't talk about it much, it's not the big deal is not made about it, but in 1937, the S&P 500 was down 35, and the small cap value was down 50.6. My point is that if we looked at all of the losing years for the S&P 500, and there were 24 of them over that 89-year period, the average loss for the S&P was 13.6%. The average loss for small cap value, and here's where we have to be careful of that word average, but the average loss for small cap value was 13.8%. So what that says theoretically is when the S&P 500 stinks, so does small cap value, but on average, not as much as you might believe. But let me tell you where that comes from. There were 4 years that the S&P 500 lost money and small cap value did well. In 77, in 81, in 2000 and 2001. So that average came with some wild differences. And one of the things we're always looking for is an asset class that will go up when another one goes down. And certainly sometimes that's true with the S&P and small cap value. Now, it wouldn't be fair to be picking on the S&P 500 if we didn't look carefully at small cap value. And yes, there were 8 years that small cap value lost money that the S&P 500 made money. 8 years, about 10% of the years. And the average profit during those 8 years for the S&P, a gain of 6.6. For the small cap value, a loss of 6.9. So I don't want to pretend that there aren't going to be uncomfortable periods with small cap value, but maybe to find out that the difference in the financial pain that you're going to feel is not going to be all that different, likely. But what really was the bigger wake-up call in terms of comparison is not just this difference between the S&P 500 and small cap value, but most of the, in fact, almost all, not all, but almost all of the 401k plans that we have analyzed that have small cap in their offerings have small cap blend, not small cap value. And by the way, I should also mention that many of the plans do not have any small cap, either blend or small cap value. So those certainly need to be fixed. But for all those people who think that offering small cap blend is a great break for their participants, have probably not analyzed the differences between the returns of small cap blend and small cap value. So let me tell you what I found out. There were, from 1928 through 2016, there were 28 losing years for small cap blend. And the average loss was 16.1%. Now, you may recall earlier I talked about the returns of small cap blend versus small cap value. Let me remind you The difference was 12.2 for small cap blend and 13.5 for small cap value. That was 1 year at a time, the compound rate of return per year. But when you look at the average 40-year period, the difference is 13.8 for small cap blend and 16.2 for small cap value. That's a big deal. But again, let's go back and see if the difference in risk is enough to scare us off from small cap value. And what I'm seeing is there's only 0.1% difference. And when I look at the really catastrophic years like 1931 and 1937 and 2008, the difference in return between small cap value and small cap blend was very little, less than 10% in the worst of cases, and normally just a couple of percent difference. So I'm thinking that trustees who are thoughtful enough to include a small cap asset class choice should be considering small cap value instead of small cap blend. Now, there were 2 years that small cap value lost money and small cap blend made money. But there were also 2 years that small cap blend lost money, that's all small cap value made money. So everything that I could see here would say, if you're going to offer small cap, make it value. Now, I just want to add something, because I saw out of maybe 100 plus 401k plans, maybe 3%, or maybe it's 5%, offer a small cap value, and they offer DFA small cap value. And DFA really is, I think, the best provider in terms of how they build their and manage their small cap value passively managed fund. We can't really truly call it an index because it doesn't track an exact index, but it is as passively managed as an index fund. And here's the thing that I find fascinating. Here are trustees who have gone far enough into the weeds to find DFA, get the right to put DFA in their 401k, and doggone if it isn't the only DFA fund they use. At the same time, they pick other funds that are really inferior to DFA. And boy, would I like to be a fly in the room on that one, because how you could pick a DFA fund and ignore it in the other asset classes is beyond me. But that's what happened. Anyway, I'm thinking that if you can have any impact on the small cap offerings within your 401k, well, if you can do it with a DFA, that's great, but I would certainly try to use small cap value rather than small cap blend. One more thing about performance that I am really was excited to be able to share with you is the article. It was mentioned in the MarketWatch article, and there was a link to it. But if you didn't read that article, Chris Pedersen, who has been working with us on our ETF portfolios, which includes both the work that's at paulmerriman.com as well as the work at Motif, he did a study and then made an article out of that entitled Resiliency: How Fast Do Different Asset Classes Recover? Now, I'll just read a little bit about this so you'll know what he was up to here. He says, we live at an amazing time. Today, there is more information available about historical investment asset class performance than ever before. And much of it is available for free on the internet. One of my favorite resources for investing data is the Portfolio Visualizer website. And one of the questions it recently let me answer is, how do different U.S. asset classes perform in market downturns? To answer the question, I looked at two different kinds of analysis on the website. Backtesting, which analyzes the historical sequence of returns, and Monte Carlo simulation, which scrambles the history to create a larger number of imagined possible future scenarios. The backtesting tells us how each asset class has performed during downturns in the past, and the Monte Carlo simulation attempts to tell us how they might perform in the future. There are, of course, no guarantees, but since the past is our only guide to the future, I think it is still worth a look. Here's the backtesting return data for the four U.S. equity asset classes in the ultimate buy and hold portfolio. And then in parens, he states, I'm limiting analysis to these because they have the longest histories available, close parens. And so then he shows large value and small value and large blend and small blend. And remember that blend is a combination of growth and value. What is interesting here is that this return, starting in 1972 through the end of 2016, shows that large value compounded at 11.34 with a standard deviation of 14.75 versus large blend, that would be the S&P 500, compounded at 10.23 with a standard deviation of 15.1. So there was actually a little more volatility, not significant, in the blend than in the value. When we look at the small value, the compound rate of return, 14.36, versus the blend, small blend, of 11.86. There's a significant difference in return there. And the small value, the standard deviation, 17.83 versus 19.40 for the small cap blend. So small cap value had made significantly more money, life-changing, if it represented a lot of a portfolio, and accomplished that with less volatility than the small blend. So that was certainly not something that that Chris was expecting. Then in the rest of the article, he studies the period of time it takes to recover from a loss. And there's a lot of material here, some nice graphs. I hope you'll go read the article. We'll include a link to this article in the description material about the podcast. But here's the bottom line. Looking at how long it takes for different asset classes to recover the losses that they sustain in a large drawdown. And the bottom line is, of all of these asset classes, large value, small value, large blend, and small blend, the quickest to recover was small cap value. And the S&P 500, which would be large blend, There actually was a 10-year period, whereas in the case of small value, it was 7 years. Quite a big advantage to the small cap value. I know these things don't tell us what the future will bring, but I will give Chris credit. He turns this stuff inside out to try to give you as good a sense on that you can learn the best lessons that we have from the past. And here's his summary. What he says, so what do we learn from all this data and analysis? So here are the bullet points. Small and value asset classes have had greater long-term returns than large and blend. Second bullet point, value asset classes are not necessarily more volatile than blend. The third, small cap value drawdowns were only 2 to 5% more than large and blend. A drawdown, by the way, is from a peak to a valley, the bottom of the valley, before you go back up to where that drawdown started. Number four, large cap value and large cap blend took the longest to recover from their worst market downturns. Number five, small cap value and small cap blend have recovered the fastest from their worst market downturns. And I think if I am picking these numbers up right, there was on average about a 2-year advantage to the small value over the large value. So number six, Monte Carlo simulations can help set reasonable expectations about future performance for specific portfolio allocations. And finally, Monte Carlo simulations also suggest that small cap value will recover faster than large and blend asset classes in future downturns. I want to make sure that I don't overlook comments about international value, because the advantages that are found in the U.S. for small value and large value are also found in the international markets. That includes not only developed markets, but the emerging markets, the developing markets. And so, as you may know, in the motif portfolios that were in essence building for a child's lifetime, those are early on combinations of U.S. and international small cap value and an emerging market value. The other thing I think it's important to consider is that expenses are just as important with value as they are for blend. And generally speaking, you're going to find that it's going to be a bit more expensive for value, and it's going to be even more expensive for small value, and maybe even a little more expensive for emerging market value. Some of these markets do take more work to manage the portfolios, even as an index or passive portfolio. And I hope you won't get trapped by this thinking that all that matters are expenses, because I've had people say to me that they're so focused on expenses, they wouldn't see why anybody would ever invest in anything but the S&P 500, because those expenses are the lowest of all. Well, if you take that approach, you're going to have to give up on having some of the most profitable asset classes not included in your portfolio, because they do cost more than the S&P 500. So look both at the expected return and the expenses. And I hope you don't get convinced by somebody that because the small cap value, whether it's U.S. or international or emerging markets, because these areas are less well known by the very large funds, and that means that it's easier to find inefficiencies. This is what they claim. It's easier to find inefficiencies, and there's greater possibility of additional profits with active management than passive, and that is totally false. When you look at the long term returns of these less efficient, and they are less efficient because they're not as liquid as the S&P 500. But the underperformance of with these less efficient asset classes are virtually the same as the underperformance of those actively managed funds in the more efficient asset classes like the S&P 500. And finally, I want to circle around, where I'm hoping you might apply some of this knowledge. For many of you, you may be target date fund kinds of investors, and you've got your 401k all in a target date fund, which is great. But I do think if you'll take the step of adding small cap value to that 401k, that you will raise your long-term returns significantly, 10, 20, 30, even 40%, depending on your age, would make sense. And let's say you don't have a small cap value in your 401k plan. Well, what you could do, make sure you do your match, make sure you do that match, and then maybe the next dollars that you invest go into a Roth IRA, and if that is possible. And that's where you do your small cap value. So if you can find a way to work that into your portfolio, and again, as I said earlier, in this podcast, I think a small cap value ETF or mutual fund, index fund, I think those could be the base of starting a young person's portfolio that's going to be applied to their retirement investments when they get to be in their 20s. So I hope for those of you who were kind of still on the fence of really a little concerned about getting in something so risky as small cap value, that this information in the article, in Chris's article, as well as the article that Rich and I wrote, and now this podcast, I hope we've made some headway here in getting you to consider seriously some small cap value. And maybe you'll have to do it with a relatively small amount and gain that confidence from being there, seeing how it compares. It's going to take a few years. You can't judge 1 or 2 or even 3 years because it can be so different. But you got to get started somewhere, and a small amount is probably better than nothing at all. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll pass this on to others that it might help. And again, if you haven't read the article, I hope you will, especially the one that Chris wrote regarding resiliency. Thanks again.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.